Welcome, Rabbi Schwartz. First of all, this morning's shiur is sponsored by Ken and Karen Anolik, wishing a refuah shlema for Margalit Yael Ben Rachel. So everybody should have a refuah shlema during these difficult times. It's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Alan Schwartz, who I guess I go back for, I don't want to say how many years, 40 years. We sat next to each other in the Kollel on the third floor in the first hall. Schwartz in front of the bank.
Okay.
For 1 year, we were sitting kind of, we never spoke to each other. We were too busy learning to do any Bittul Torah. Rabbi Schwartz has been teaching at Yeshiva University for many, many years. And he's been the rabbi, of course, of OZ, Ohev Tzedek Congregation on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, really turned into a thriving shul, hundreds of people. And it's very involved in many community endeavors. And it's a pleasure to welcome here to be part of our Tanakh series and to teach the 85 psukim of Megillat Ruth. It's a lot easier than, let's say, the 150 chapters of Tehillim. So,
Bakasha.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think it's easier.
All right, I'll try to do that in the time allotted. And Kelman, Yeshikoch to you for all the amazing work you're doing. The Torah is always in motion in where you are. And if that's a true background right behind you, that's a really blessed room you have. And you have done amazing things since the time we were together in yeshiva. And it's lahagdil Torah lahadira. And I thank you for allowing me to be part of your amazing work. My daughter just got married 2 days ago. And so I'd like to dedicate this to Esther and Aaron. It was her bas mitzvah speech that was all about Rus because she was born right around Shavuos, 2 days before Shavuos. And she spoke about Rus, so I'm going to quote some of her Torah from her bas mitzvah speech, which I admit I did work on with her. So, Rus, I would like to suggest to you today, the mahalach, the direction we'll be taking, is to show how this short book of 85 verses is a corrective. It corrects a lot of things that have been happening in history from its own time, which is, of course, Shvot HaShoftim, the time of the judging of the judges, but even way back to the time of Bereshis. The first thing that just jumps out at you on the entirety of the book is the thematic, linguistic, and even in some cases, some of the verse manipulation of the books of a particular parsha of the Torah. That weekly portion is Parshat Vayeshev. The first amazing Masoretic connection is that in both books, and nothing even comes close to this in the Torah, and certainly not in the books of the Neviim and Ksuvim, is that every one but eight psukim in both Parshas Vayeshev and Parshas and the Book of Ruth begin with the letter Vav. Question you could ask, what does that mean? A story where so many verses begin with the letter Vav means that everything in the story is interconnected. Rus has only 85 psukim, Parshas Vayeshev has 112. So the only thing that comes even remotely close to this in the Torah is Parshas Vayetze. But nothing else is the statistic deviation to this is so profound. It's, you can do the math. You know, 8 out of 85 psukim means that only 1 out of 10 or a little less, and 8 out of 112 is even less than this, where so many of the psukim are connectors with connecting events. In each one, each small little event that would be disconnected and the story would be lost. This point may be true about Megillat Esther also, where every little detail in the beginning of the story comes out to be woven into the story at the end, is also crucial, but you don't have this Masoretic point of every verse beginning with the letter Vav. The word Vav, the letter Vav in Hebrew, which literally means a hook, the letter Vav is a hook. It hooks different things, Yom Valayla, day and night. The word generally means and what it does is it connects an event to another event. So so right now I'm connecting Rus to Parshas Vayeshev, and the thematic connection, of course, is mostly related to chapter 38 of that parsha, where Yehuda loses two sons, And there, within that loss is the opportunity to perpetuate the name of a man who died without children and a refusal. That takes place at the end of our story, where also two boys die in the beginning of the story, and there is an opportunity to perpetuate the memory of one of them, and someone refuses. There's a fascinating linguistic connection between these two, is that the refusal of the man in Megillat Rut to do so, I'm going to try to be consistent, I'm going to call it Rut, not Ruth or Rus, but I'll try to call it Rut. In the refusal, the man who refuses says, Pen ashchit et nachlati. If I marry this woman who stems from Moab, I will destroy, I will wipe out my future. I'll wipe out my inheritance. And that's precisely the word that is used in the Torah for the refusal of Onan to perpetuate the name of his brother Er, who died without children. It's a very unusual terminology for the Torah there. I expect such a word in Rut, but when it says that Er married the widow Tamar and he actually began to consummate the marriage, but just at the end he said, you know, if I impregnate Tamar, her child will belong to everyone will consider him to be like someone else, like my brother, through my brother. So it says, Vatishoches Zaro Arza. It says he destroyed his seed onto the floor. Not he spilled shofach or he peeled, but Vatishoches. In both these stories, there is a refusal to perpetuate the name of a dead man without children. And I get the point. Most people would not want to marry someone where she would rather be married to someone else. She's a widow. But B, every time she calls her child's name, she's thinking of another man. So in both these instances, there is a refusal to perpetuate. And now let's get down to the story. And so that that's a teaser to get you connected to Parshat Vayeshev. But it's so much more than that. If both books, both the book and the parsha, have every pasuk, every verse but eight that begin with the letter Vav, it means that there's something more than just the story of Yehuda and Tamar. The story is about the sale of Yosef. There's a lot more that needs to be corrected here, and the issue of responsibility. And now let's get on to the larger story at hand. The story begins by Vayihi bimei Shvot HaShoftim, which can connect us also to the book of Esther thematically, again, where there's the hook of every event. But these are the only two books of the Bible that begin this way, Vayihi bimei. There are three other times where the terminology appears in Tanakh, but these are the only two books that begin this way. The Talmud insists that this always leads to some kind of troubling situation. Vayihi bimei Shvot HaShoftim, what is so troubling about Shvot HaShoftim? And I place it to you here. Shoftim is close to a 500-year period between the book of Joshua and the book of Samuel, book of Shmuel. Joshua finishes off the Torah basically by settling Israel in the land. In fact, early Christian Bibles had what's called the Hexateuch. They believed that Yahushua was part of the Torah because Yahushua is just what should have happened when right after we left Egypt is the entrance into the land of Israel. In fact, there's a Gemara in Nedarim that says, if not for the sinful nature of the Israelites, our whole Bible would just consist of the five books of the Torah and the book of Yahushua. So put that aside for now. And the book of Shmuel introduces the monarchy of Israel. The book of Shoftim is a list of 13 leaders of Israel. And there were two other Shoftim, according to our tradition, Eli and Shmuel in the next book. But there are 13 leaders in the book of Shoftim. And I submit to you that the words Vayihi bimei Shvot HaShoftim comes to fix something awful in the book of Shoftim. So in order to fully get the message of Rus, we have to know, Ruth, we have to know what is the problem of Sefer Shoftim that needs to be fixed. And here it is, I submit to you. The 13 stories in this book, some would have large stories, some that have just references to the Shoftim. And each of them, some stories larger than others, Shimshon gets four chapters. Yiftach gets two chapters. Right? Some Shoftim just get to one pasuk. But there are 13 of them. And what happens to all 13 is the same story, and the book tells you not once, but twice, this cycle of events that takes place. The Israelites enter the land and succeed and become fat, like the words of the Torah. Vayishman yishurun vayivot. And when the Israelites become fat, they tend to kick back. They kick and they, v'rom levavecha v'shachachtu es Hashem. Our hearts become too haughty and arrogant, and it makes us forget God. So that when we turn this way, God uses some of the remaining people in Canaan, the Moabites, the Ammonites, there are sometimes Philistines, different nations, the Midianites are called together to chip away at some of the haughtiness of the Israelites, and they actually defeat us and sometimes enslave us, put us to confiscatory taxation and worse, for sometimes 2 years, 4 years, sometimes as much as 18 years. And the Israelites call out to God in their pain and affliction at this subjugation. And God finally hears their cries and sends them what's called a shofet. The shofet in Hebrew means judge. I'm not sure if judges, which of course is a terminology in Latin that was given by Christians to the books of the Bible that we have found convenient. I'm not sure if these are judges. Only one of the 13 actually sits in judgment, and that's Devorah. She sits beneath the tomer of Devorah and judges the people. Other than that, I do not see that Yiftach had a court or that Ifzan had a court, but we do see, though, that they're all called Vayishpot et Yisrael Arba'im Shana. It says Vayishpot. I would like to suggest, based on another verse at the end, very much later in the Bible, in the book of Ovadia, in Treasar, the Olum Moshiim Bahar Tzion Lishpot et Haresav. The saviors, those who brought salvation, came to judge the land. So I think that the people in Sefer Shoftim are better translated as saviors. They're Moshiim. They saved the people from this subjugation, whether it's Midian for Gidon, or whether it's Ammon for Yiftach, whoever it may be, Plishtim for Shimshon, and they came to save the people from this subjugation. And they brought a degree of prosperity back to the land, and certainly peace. And this prosperity made the Israelites become haughty once again. V'rom lebavecha v'shachachta es Hashem started again. And this stupid cycle, I can't call it anything but that, appears 13 times again and again and again. When are the Israelites going to learn to serve God even in their prosperity? If we would serve God in our prosperity, then we wouldn't have to cry out to him in our trial and tribulation. So this is what happens in Sefer Shoftim. And what's being corrected, though, is that all 13 of these subjugations are met largely with apathy from any tribe in Israel that is not being subjugated. There is not one of these 13 Shoftim who fight against the enemy with all of Israel. In fact, some of them complain about why is it, says Devorah in Shiras Devorah, that Shevet Reuven felt that they don't need to help the tribes that are being threatened by Yavin Melech Chatzor and Sisera. Why are the people just sitting in their own backyards and tending to their own flocks and their own vineyards without considering the fact that in much of Israel, Jews are being destroyed and subjugated by a foreign entity? Imagine Jews in the north of Israel saying, well, those bombs coming from Sderot, that doesn't affect me here in Haifa. I don't care about that. I'm not going to sign up for Miluim for that. Let me know if they, right? Imagine the people in the south saying, well, the Hezbollah rockets can't reach me here in Sderot. Yeah. Remember, a Jew threatened anywhere is a Jew threatened everywhere. That's why at the end of Megillat Esther, Haman is called not just Tzorer HaYehudim, he's called Tzorer Kol HaYehudim. The Jews who lived in walled cities thought they'd be safe from Haman's decree. That's why Ramban says we have to keep two different days for Purim. Because let the Jews know, even if you feel that you are safe in a walled city, you're never safe from the anti-Semite. The Jew who's being threatened in the south of Israel is a threat to a Jew everywhere in Israel. And we've learned since then that's a threat to a Jew everywhere in the world. So that the Devorah complains, why are the Jews not living in the areas where we're threatened? They don't feel that they need to step up to the plate for the sake of their brethren. and this happens throughout Sefer Shoftim. Gidon almost goes to war with one of the tribes. Yiftach does go to war with one of the tribes. He killed 42,000 men from Shevet Ephraim. Crazy story, right? Shimshon never fought with any tribe at all. In fact, he was handed into the enemy by the tribe of Yehuda. The fractious nature of Sefer Shoftim is so miserable that by the end of the book, almost one of the tribes is totally almost wiped out from Israel. That's the tribe of Benjamin. And it started with a crazy story. It's if you don't know the story, you wouldn't believe it unless you saw it inside, where a woman is cut up into 12 pieces and sent to each tribe to show what a terrible thing the tribe of Benjamin did. And they're almost wiped out because of this. I tell you this very unpleasant story because our first king, when he fights a battle to save the eyes that see of the people of Yavesh Gilad, the Ammonites were testing to see if Shaul, the newly minted king of Israel, would stand up and unite the people. That was the test. He said that every male of Yavesh Gilad must pull out his right eye or we'll kill all of you. And no other tribe cared to save the people from Yavesh Gilad. And Shaul, the new king, came and told everybody in Israel, you need to come out in great numbers for the sake of all these people. And no one wanted to fight, so Shaul takes an ox and cuts it into 12 pieces to fix Sefer Shoftim. And he sends one piece to every tribe and says, this is what I'm going to do to everyone's cattle if you don't come out to help the people of Yavesh Gilad. And hundreds of thousands of them came out to fight to save their brothers. And that is how Sefer Shoftim is fixed by Shaul, and it is fixed by Rus in this book. And that's my introduction. I see about a violent history. I know I'm not supposed to respond, but the violent history is here is that we're responding to the violence. We're responding. Shaul is responding to the violence of the Ammonites. And yes, no doubt that Sefer Yehoshua and Shoftim does have a degree of violence. It was a violent time, and we sometimes had to respond to violence in kind. So we begin now by Yibimei Shvot HaShoftim. We have to, the author of this book, who Chazal say is written by Shmuel himself. So Shmuel knows this history. He wrote Sefer Shoftim also. And he's also the author, of course, of the first 25 chapters of Shmuel Aleph. And Chazal tells us in Bava Basra that Nosson and God finished off Shmuel, the rest of Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet after Shmuel dies. And he knows that he has to write a book that has to fix the ills of Sefer Shoftim, where there's no unity. And I have to put out there, says Shmuel, a story that fixes as much as possible. Now I take you back by Hira of Ba'aretz. There is famine in the land. This is not the first famine in Tanakh. In fact, the first Targum to Megillas Rus refers to 10 famines in the history of the world. And the 10th one, I submit to you, I'm going to finish with this again. The 10th one is what we are satisfying now. Lo ra'av la'lechem v'lo tzama la'mayim kim lishmo es divrei Hashem. It's a famine not for bread or water. It's a famine to hear the word of God. Look at the first Targum to Megillas Rus and you'll be inspired. And the Vayelach Ish mi beis lechem Yehuda lagur b'shtei Moav. Look at this. The same problem of Sefer Shoftim. The same problem of brothers who will not perpetuate a brother's name is that there's responsibility to be had and he shirks responsibility. The fact is, the Gemara in Daf Tzadik Aleph in the Seches Baba Basra says that in a time of famine, you're allowed to leave Israel, but not if your name is Elimelech. Not if your name, the Ramban takes Avram to task for leaving so quickly, for leaving Israel so quickly in time of famine. Had Avram said, I'm not leaving, God wouldn't tell me to leave Mesopotamia to come to Canaan to die of starvation. I'm staying here. Then Yaakov wouldn't have left either. Look at the Nedarim Daf Lamed Daled and you'll see all this is there. So, and Ramban in chapter 12 of Bereishis. But so here, Chazal say that Elimelech also is to be blamed for leaving Israel at a time of famine. We see from the end of this chapter that Naomi was an influential person. Elimelech was an influential person. Chazal say they were Gedolei Hador. And they should have stuck it out. The captain should stay on the ship. You shouldn't be the first person to leave. So he's behaving like everyone in Sefer Shoftim, and he's behaving like Onan, and he's behaving like Ploni Almoni, and bad things happen in a book like this when you behave this way. I want to do two things still as part of our introduction, is that Chazal darshan every name that appears in this book. The reason why they do this, more than any other book of the Bible, no doubt. Somewhere in Chazal, you can find a drasha about the name of Esther, or even Mordechai, or Vashti, or Ahasuerus, or Gemara at the end of Cholin. But nothing resembles the fact that every single name in this book is darshan, because Naomi darshans her name in this book. The text darshans the name. She says, well, is that Naomi coming back after 10 years with a husband and two sons, looking 30, 40 years older with no boys, no children, but this strange woman? Who is this? And she says, don't call me Naomi because I'm not pleasant. Call me Mara because I am bitter. So once we darshan, once the text itself darshans her name, so that gave Chazal and Rus Rabbah license to darshan every name. Elimelech, because he prophetically viewed himself as the progenitor of the Davidic dynasty. He said, Eli Yavo Malchus, and he was almost right. His son was married to Ruth, right? His son was married to the great-grandmother of the king of Israel, but because you shirked responsibility, look what's going to happen. Elimelech dies, and then his sons marry Moabite women. There's no one else to marry. And then they stay for 10 years and then they die. What should they have done? They had to go out with their father. What they should have done is take those women back to Israel with you. That's how Elimelech would have been the progenitor of Mashiach, of King David. If his son had gone back to Israel with Ruth. All right, look, whatever it meant to be was meant to be. But it was time to go back to Israel. All right, the famine is still on. Okay, their problem wasn't that they had no resources. Right, the problem was that they wanted an easy way out, like everyone else in Sefer Shoftim. V'shem Oish Elimelech, v'shem Ishto Naomi, v'shem Shnei Vanov Machlon V'Chilion. My goodness, who names a child dysentery and cholera? Machlon V'Chilion means disease and destruction. What kind of names are these? So there's a Gemara in Bava Basra that says that actually they had different names. They're named in Divrei Yamim, and these were names that were given to them by Shmuel because of how the story ends. Okay, fair enough. And they married two women named Rus and Orpah. Orpah is named because she turned her neck. Orif means neck. She turned her neck on Naomi. Rus, either that she is named for the future, for David, Sheriva, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, B'Shiros V'Sishpachos. Right? And I see this. I remind you that Avraham left in time of famine because, and he's punished for it. Gemara in the Darim, the Flamadalad says that we had to go to Egypt because Avram left to Egypt. And Yaakov went because Avram left. So keep that in mind, just the way these people are being punished for leaving during time of famine. You could look on at Bava Basra, Daf Tzadik Aleph for this whole discussion, and Nedarim, Daf Flamadalad for this discussion. And of course, Ramban in Bereishis chapter 12. So her husband dies, her boys die, and I would like to consider a chart of the nine characters of Megillas Rus. There are nine characters in the whole book. And the opening statement of Rus Rabbah, which is one of the oldest pieces of Jewish literature that we have in our hands outside of the Tanakh. Take that to the bank. Really, it's one of the oldest material outside of the Dead Sea Scrolls that's considered mainstream Jewish material. Bereishis Rabbah, Vayikra Rabbah, and Rus Rabbah are the three of the oldest, even older than the Chilta, older than the Mishnah, of course, and the Gemara, and the other Midrashim. Rus Rabbah begins by saying, Ein b'sefer zu lo tumah v'tahara, lo iser v'heter. There is no halacha in this book. There is no purity and impurity. No prohibitions and no permissions. The only point of this book is kocho shel chesed. Power of chesed to take a woman, a convert from Moab, a hated nation. Her father or grandfather, according to Chazal, was the king of Moab, Eglon, who subjugated us for 18 years. He's one of those subjugating kings in Sefer Shoftim. And the Torah also tells us, Lo yavo amoni o Moabi b'kal Hashem. Ammonites and Moabites are not allowed to enter the Kehillah because they didn't greet us with bread and water when we left Egypt. Good Shabbos, no nation greeted us with bread and water when we left Egypt. By that measure, no nation should be allowed to convert. No, says the Gemara. The Gemara says that the reason why Ammon and Moab are punished more than any other nation, even Amalek and Plishtim, anyone else can convert to Judaism, but not a male from Ammon and Moab. I don't mean to spoil things right now, but right now, no one apparently from Moab at all can join the Kehillah. They can marry, no one from Moab can marry a Jewish person. So Machlam Chilion violated the halacha. We'll see at the end of the story how Ploni, Amoni, and Boaz feel about this. And there's no love lost for Moabites in Israel. That's what Naomi tries to tell these two women, to go back home. Why do you want to come with me? So they're both, at first, they are motivated by a streak of chesed, but Orpah turns her neck on her mother-in-law and returns to Moab because she realizes, yeah, I have nothing for me in Israel. Who's going to want to marry me, right? In fact, Naomi says, there is no one. The only one who would possibly want to marry you is a child of mine. And you're going to wait for me to be with a man, even if I was with a man tonight and I conceived tonight, you're going to wait till this child is old enough to marry you? That would contravene, by the way, Maseches Yevamos, because that boy would be Achiv Shelohaya Ba'olamo. You're not allowed to marry such a brother. But all right, but put that aside right now. But Naomi's trying to convince them that there's no man in Israel who's going to want to marry you. That's for sure. So go back home. So the Gemara, the Medrash Rus Rabbah says that the purpose of the book is to teach the immense power of Chesed. That Chesed could take a hated woman and make her the great grandmother of the King of Israel, Imo Shel Malchus, because of the power of Chesed. But wait a second. I have a big question on Megillas on Rus Rabbah. This book is filled with halacha. Chapter 1 has a myriad of halachas of laws of conversion. Chapter 2 has in Yerushalmi Peya a host of halachas about gifts and tithes and gifts that are to be left in the field. Lekat Shikhan Peya. Chapter 3 has halachos of Yichud. Chapter 4, Yibam and Chalitza and Geula Sod. There is so much halacha. In fact, I submit to you that for the short 85 Psukim of Rus has more compact halacha than any other book of the certainly Ksuvim and probably Nevi'im too. So what are you telling me, Rus Rabbah, that this book has no halacha in it, just the power of Chesed? I think with the Medrash, if I may give it my interpretation, is that the book of Ruth has lots of halacha. It's just that the power of chesed is more important than that in this book. And look at the graph. Look at the chart now, right now. There are 9 characters in the book of Ruth. 3 do negative chesed. They do less than is expected. Who are they? Elimelech for leaving, Mahlon and Chilion for not returning when they should have. And what happens to you in a book that tries to bring home the point of chesed when you do negative chesed? I'm sorry, you die. That's what happens to these 3 people. They die. Look, by the time that Yehuda tells one of his sons, listen, Onan, your brother just died. He never had a child. Go marry his wife and name a child after your poor brother. Right? So he agrees. He takes her. He goes, he sleeps with her. But then he refuses to impregnate her. And he spills his seed, Vatishaches Arutzah. I began with this point. You see, until now, brotherhood has been suffering significantly in Sefer Bereishis. From Cain and Hevel to Yitzchak and Yishmael, I might even add in this, the brothers Lot and Avraham, they're shepherds, to Yaakov and Esav. Brothers do not get along in this book, for goodness sakes. And finally, a brother says, Yehuda already started to get the message when he essentially saved Yosef's life, because the brothers wanted to actually kill him on the spot. And he said, let not our blood be on his head, because he is Achinu. After all, he's our brother. First time in Sefer Bereishis that someone acknowledges a brother as Yehuda. And then he loses 2 of his own sons. And he says to he loses a son. He says to the second son, take your brother. Do something good to a brother. By this time in Sefer Bereishis, what happens to Onan is what happened to Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion. He dies for this, right? And then the saga continues. Because when Yaakov refuses to allow Binyamin to accompany the people, the brothers, to get food in Egypt, right? When Yaakov refuses to take Binyamin along, to allow Binyamin to go, and he puts everyone in danger for lack of food, and he says, listen, his mother died in the derech, his brother died in the derech, this, I can't let him go. There's already a chazakah that these children, the people from this side of the family die on the path. I can't let Binyamin go. And Reuven tries after some time to convince his father, let me be in charge of Binyamin. If I don't bring him back, you can kill my two sons. Oh yeah, really? You think that if your father loses a second son, he can console himself by killing two grandchildren? What are you, how crazy are you? Obviously, Reuven doesn't mean that. He means, I'm so sure that I'll bring Binyamin back alive. Put me in charge. I know so sure that as much as so that I wouldn't kill my own two children. So Yehuda, that's not convincing to Yaakov. Yehuda, however, is able to convince him. And this is a powerful message for Ruth. Reuven says, listen, I can't be as sure as my brother, Reuven, is that I'll bring home Binyamin alive. But I know what you're going through because I already lost two sons. Two of my sons have already died. I will not let you lose a second son. And Yehuda teaches Arevus. Yehuda teaches that we can take responsibility. Responsibility that was not taken by Onan, not taken by Elimelech, not taken by Machlon and Chilion. And I'm sorry to say these four people die at this point when not taking the initiative. Now, there are also three characters in Megillas Rus who do not positive chesed, but just what's expected of them. Which three people in this book do just what's expected? Because chesed is more than what's expected. Tzedek and tzedakah is expected. Charity is not a good Hebrew-English translation for tzedakah. Tzedakah is tzedek. It's expected. It's legislated. We expect a Jew to be charitable. But we cannot legislate chesed. Chesed has to come from an outpouring, open heart. So who are so far two people, correct? Orpah do exactly what's expected to go back home. Ploni Almoni does exactly as expected, right? We don't love Moabites here, and I'm not going to destroy my family by marrying someone the Torah says cannot join our Kehila. Who's the third person? He usually goes under the radar. The Na'ar who introduces Ruth to Boaz in a way the Gemara says is somewhat derogatory. So the Na'ar means that everybody collecting and gleaning that day who would look at not just a convert, but a Moabite. Who is this Moabite? I mean, it's a question really we have to ask, but it's beyond our scope. But today, I'm just leaving you the question. When did Ruth convert? According to the Gemara in Yevamos, Daf Memvav, she converted on the way home with Naomi. I don't know, with what? Was there a place to dunk? Was there a base? I don't know. What kind of conversion was that? Maybe at that time, just saying, Ki Hashem, your God is my God. That's the conversion. I don't know. But Ibn Ezra insists that some kind of formal conversion took place in Moab. It must have. Because if she had not returned home as a Jewish woman, there would never be an inyan of Yibam, of perpetuating the name of Machlon, who died while married to a non-Jewish woman. She had to have embraced some kind of Judaism in Moab already. Ibn Ezra says this very clearly. And by the way, some modern poskim say that it's a sign that there are like two stages to the conversion. One, when you begin the process, where you start identifying like Rabbi Kelman's brother does in identifying people who want to convert. And the second part is at the end of the process. But that person is considered somewhat Jewish all along the line. It's a fascinating position. But how can Ibn Ezra say that she converted in Moab? There was no, in what? With what? Who converted her? Right? Ibn Ezra insists that if she's not considered a Jewish woman before Machlon dies, chapter 4 really makes no sense. Right? What offer is Boaz giving to Ploni Almoni in the first place? I have a different answer to that question. I think Boaz pulled a fast one on Ploni Almoni. Right? There's certainly no obligation even if she was Jewish back home. Boaz is, and neither Boaz nor Ploni Almoni is the brother of Machlon. They're at best cousins, right? So there's certainly no obligation. If there's time at the end, or if someone wants to ask about that, you can do so. So the three people who do just what's expected of them are Ploni Almoni, Orpah, and the Na'ar, who introduces her in a derogatory way. Who are the three people who do positive chesed? So that's Rus, by giving up every opportunity to get on with her life in Moab. Remember, especially if Chazal are correct that she's the king's daughter or granddaughter, she's giving up plenty. Chazal like to do that. Hagar was the king's daughter. Rus is the king's daughter. Everyone who joins us is always the king's daughter, right? Tamar is the king's daughter, right? Malki Tzedek's daughter. Chazal say that, you know, they would prefer to be just a regular person with us than royalty. So Rus gives up so much back in Moab just to accompany Naomi. And by the way, Naomi also does a chesed. There's evidence in chapter 3 that Naomi really wants Boaz. When she tells in the beginning of chapter 3, if you have the text in front of you and you could look at the Masorah, and it says, V'rachatz, V'sacht, V'samtzim, L'sayich, V'yaradit, V'shachavt, the Masorah puts a yud at the end of many of those words, as if to say that Naomi wants Boaz. She wants to go to the Goren. Boaz, according to Rus Rabba, is 80 years old. Naomi is 60 and Ruth is 40. Naomi wants Boaz, right? It's not a good match between that Boaz and Ruth. But Naomi convinced her, there's no man who wants to marry you here, so take any offer you get, right? So Naomi's chesed is, you know what? This young woman once chose her mother-in-law over her mother. So I'm going to get her the man when I want the man. Right? That's the chesed that Naomi places. What's the chesed of Boaz, though? I mean, when she comes to the field in chapter 2, and Boaz asks, well, who's the new woman here? Rashi says, v'chidarko shel Boaz, it's Boaz's way to recognize new women. So the Medrash, Rashi gives the two answers to the Medrash. One is that she gleaned according to the halacha. You're only allowed to glean one or two strands, one or two stalks, or one or two bundles. For shikha, one or two stalks for leket. And she said, Valakta bashibalim, I went to get Beis Shibalim. The Yerushalmi and Peah makes a nice drash out of this. And also she gleaned with a tznius way. Other women revealed themselves, or, you know, a woman who wants to be tznius will be recognized and noted by a man who likes tznius. He's going to get a good guy. But the woman who exposes herself might be, attract the attention of someone who not on the level of a Boaz. So Boaz recognizes her, and notice that he knew that his aunt had Naomi came by, had come back, right? When the women said, "Hazos Naomi," you can sense a degree of Schadenfreude that this woman who left us hungry, now look how she comes back looking 30 years older, 10 years later without any boys, no husband, and who's this girl she's with? And the word started to spread that the Na'ar already knew the next day to tell Boaz what was going on. And notice he doesn't give them a handout. At that time in history, the Yerushalmi says, it was such a shanda. It was a shanda. It was a shame to receive a handout. If you had to, you're starving, okay, you get a handout. But to take leket, shikha, and peah was honorable. That was a job. That was an occupation. So he gives them he favors her. You're allowed to favor someone like that. And he gives her the benefit of feeling that she earned her keep. And he gives her a little extra. He tells the people to leave some behind for her. All right, that wouldn't really strictly be peah or leket. It would be tzedakah, but she would think it's leket and peah. And shikha. So she has the dignity of getting her food without feeling that it's a handout. Otherwise, Boaz should take care of a relative like that and give them the food straight out. Right? So Boaz starts to bear responsibility. And the responsibility that he has, if any, to Naomi is not something that's in Parshas Kisetze called Yibum, but Parshas Bahar, called Geula Sodeh, to redeem the field that they had to sell. And he's ready to do that. And in fact, when Ruth compromises her tznius to some extent by going into the Goren that night, right? The whole point of the Rus Rabbah is that she has this sneeze way of picking up the grain, right? And here she compromises it by going into the granary with the man by herself, right? So the same way that Tamar compromises her characteristic modesty that Chazal say by getting back into the family with Yehuda. In both cases, there are men who are sort of dragging their feet to perform some kind of levirate marriage to perpetuate the name of a person who died childless, and the woman has to prod him to do so, as Tamar does to Yehuda, and as Rus does in the Goren to Boaz. And Boaz responds, what a chesed. This chesed is even bigger than your first one. When you chose your mother-in-law over your mother, and this chesed is even better, to choose me, the old geezer, over all those men, rich and poor, who are willing to marry, who are ready to marry you. So I have a question for you. Who's right? Who's right? Naomi in chapter 1, who said the only one who's willing to marry you will be a son of mine, right? Contravening the law of Maseches Yevamos that I mentioned before, right? Or is Boaz right, that there are plenty of men willing to marry Ruth? So I'd like to answer with like a Groucho Marxian kind of response. Remember he said, I wouldn't want to be a member of a club that would allow me to be a member. In other words, they're both right. Boaz is right. There are lots of men. There have been men since Har Sinai who've been willing to marry women that are not halachically should be married to them. But Boaz is, Naomi is right, that he said, there might be men who are willing to marry you. You shouldn't want to marry them. Right, the only worthy man in Israel for you to marry will be a son of mine, because only a son of mine already married you. But comes Boaz with a halachic ingenuity. And this is the ingenuity that helps to create the kingdom of Israel, kingdom of David. And it involves a particular ingenuity from way back in the time that the angels came to Avraham. And the angels came to Avraham, remember, at the heat of the day. And then they went on to Lot to destroy Sodom at the nighttime. Why did they go to Avraham first? Right? Why does he go to Avram first? To tell Avram his wife is going to have a baby and to inform him that Sodom is about to be destroyed. So the angels go on at night to get to Sodom. And Rashi asks the question it's in Rus Rabbah and Bereishis Rabbah. Why did the angels wait till the evening to get to Sodom? You could say in Pshat, so in order to make it easier for Lot to invite him because during the day it would be too dangerous. All right, maybe. The Medrash says that the angels complained to God because, God, come on, let us snap our fingers and get to Sodom and then later in the afternoon. They didn't spend the whole afternoon there. So the Medrash says that the angels took their time. They were told by God to wait because God wanted Avraham to have a chance to argue on behalf of the people of Sodom. Okay? Now, when the angels came to Avram the first time, the first opening statement was, Aye Sarah Ishtecha, where is Sarah your wife? And he answered, Hineba Oel, she's in the tent. Nice. What's the point of such worthless dialogue, says the Chidush Arim. He says, I don't know any more worthless dialogue in the Torah. And he says, don't say that. Based on the Gemara in Yevamos, this is the most important statement in the Torah, in Jewish history, is when Avram said, Hineba Oel. I'm not going to disappoint you. The Chidush Arim says that when the angels asked God, why do we have to take so much time to destroy Sodom? Because Avram's going to pray on their behalf and he's going to say, for what purpose, God? They're all wicked. He goes, no, they're not all wicked. There is a man there, his name is Lot, and he has two daughters. Those two daughters are going to give birth to two children. One is named Moav, and Moav is going to have a descendant named Ruth. One is named Amon, and he's going to have a descendant named Naamah. A little shout out to my new granddaughter, Naamah, in Israel. She, to Naamah, who is the mother of the king of Israel after Shlomo HaMelech. That these two, Ammonite and Moabite, need to be saved from Sodom. So God said to Abraham, the angel said to God, what's the point? Doesn't it say in your Torah, Ammonites and Moabites can't join the Kehillah? What is this? Who is this Ruth? Who is this? Who is this Naama HaAmonis? So God says, wait a second. I know it says Ammonites and Moabites can't convert and can't join our Kehillah and marry Jews. But there is a reason to differentiate between men and women. So what's the reason I said about 40 minutes ago? What's the reason that Ammonites and Moabites were accepted to join our Kehillah, make an exception from all nations? Because they didn't meet us with bread and water. They didn't give us chesed when we left Egypt. So God said, okay, that's only a reason to punish the men of Ammon and Moab, not the women. The women can't be expected to give us bread and water that we should punish them for not doing so. So the angel said, God, you can't paskin. This is going to be a dispute between Ploni Almoni and Boaz in chapter 4 of Megillas Rus. What are you telling us? So God says, okay, go down to earth and make a test. What's the test? What was their test to see if it's the way of women to greet strangers? What was the first thing they asked when they got to the tent? Ayei Sarah Ishtecha. Where is Sarah? Is she coming out to greet these three men, or the angels look like men? Like Avram is? No, she stayed in the tent. Oh, now we can save the women of Moab. Now we can save for the sake of Rus and Naama. Now Rus can join the Kehillah. But Ploni Almoni did not accept this. When Boaz pulled a fast one on Ploni Almoni and says, if you want to buy back the field, Naomi became the owner of the field when her husband and her sons died. So the field belongs to Naomi. She had to sell it, apparently. It was sold sometime before, but now there's a mitzvah of, according to the end of Sefer Vayikra, of a close relative. Naomi doesn't actually own the field. Of course not. She doesn't own it now. That's probably why you asked the question. But now there's a mitzvah, however, for close relatives, even before the Ovel year, close relatives to redeem the field and buy it back for a relative. So it stays within the family. And Boaz agrees to be that person. When Rus comes to the granary during the night in chapter 3, there's no doubt that she wants romance. She says, that is ancient language for marry me. Right? So, and he agrees to. He marries her. He's ready to marry her, but he also wants the field. He wants to buy back the property. He wants to keep it in the family as a favor to Naomi, but he doesn't have first dibs on that. The Gemara in Arachin says that the first dibs go to the closer the relative, the closer the opportunity. So there is a closer relative. He says, he tells her in bed, tells her right away. She says, ki goel ata. He doesn't say ki yovom ata, ki goel ata. You're the redeemer of the field. And Boaz makes it a package deal, which he realizes in advance. He knows Ploni Almoni is not going to say, I'll do the field and the girl, right? He doesn't say that. He knows he's not going to say. He knows that he's going to refuse the Moabite, and therefore I get the woman and the field. That's how the Shari Tshuva explains it in an amazing comment in Hilchos Pesach. Why it's there is an amazing thing in itself. But anyway, so this is how Boaz fixes a lot of what's wrong with people who shirk responsibility. The shirking of responsibility of Onan, of Machlon Chilun Elimelech in our own story. And I want to leave time for questions, Rabbi Kelman. It's okay to leave, let's go up till about 12 and then leave time for questions, right? Okay. So we have there's one more tikkun I think that needs to be made, besides the tikkun of fixing the fractious nature of Sefer Shoftim itself, of the connecting links with Parshas Vayeshev, with all the vavs and the connecting parts of the story. The brother, where you have a brother who refuses to take another brother, and at the end of the story, their twins are born at the end of the Tamar and Yehuda story to replace the two dead sons. Here, only one son is born at the end of the story because Orpah returned. I have to suspect that if Orpah returned, and the story would have ended with her marrying a Jewish man also, and two boys being born, so that the two dead boys would be replaced in our story like they're replaced in Parshas Vayeshev. But she stayed behind. Remember who Chazal say at the end of Sota? Who was Orpah's great-grandson? Right? Goliath, Who is Ruth's great grandson? David. Right? You see different destinies from those who the one who, even though it's hard to say this because that's just what's expected of her. Okay. So I have one other tikkun to make. Then I'll review all the tikkun. One other tikkun is a fascinating element that we can learn the Torah year after year and sometimes not recognize this. God's name is the most common name in the Bible. By far. Yud Kei Vav Kei, Elohim, all the names of God. There is one part of the Torah that goes longer than any other part of Torah with a total absence of God's name, certainly in the active form, and just mentioned twice in the passive form that says God will reveal Paro's dream. And why is God doing all this to us? And then Paro says, your God has revealed this to you. You must be so smart. You run the show here. Of course, I just spoiled it. I gave it away. But hear this out. And look up. You've got to open up a chumash and see it yourself. From the moment that Yosef is sold, even from the beginning of that story, where there's such hatred that leads to a brother's selling a brother, for atonement for which we must make each and every year. That's why the Meshech Chochma says in Parshas Vayeshev why we have to read about the 10 martyrs on Yom Kippur. On Tisha B'Av to elicit sadness. On Yom Kippur to elicit atonement. Because those 10 were never atoned for. That wicked Roman king who says, I need 10 rabbis to atone, it's not historical. I'm sorry. Those 10 rabbis lived too far apart to be one event to atone for Yosef's 10 brothers. There's 100 years between them. In fact, in other Midrashim, it's the angels of God saying, we don't have full atonement for Yosef. The story itself bears this out. The brothers thought that after Yaakov died, that Yosef would kill them. It doesn't seem that at the end of Bereishis that the brothers felt that they were forgiven. Yosef excused them. He explained them. But he doesn't seem to forgive them. Otherwise, why would they think he would want to kill them? Bereishis is actually saved by an unlikely hero, by Menashe. Because when Yaakov crosses over his hands and puts his right hand on the younger brother, Ephraim, only Yosef complains. It seems Menashe accepted this. So that all the fractious nature of Sefer Bereishis, of your older brothers being so jealous of the younger brothers who outshine them, that when Menashe allows it to just go on, then that serves as a harbinger for the next story where an Aaron is going to be thrilled and happy that his younger brother has all the greatness in the Gedula. Why him? He's been away for 60 years. Why? Where am I? Why? And it seems that all of Moshe's objections at the bush is because he's worried about how Aaron is going to take it that I'm getting all the greatness. It's only when Hashem tells Moshe, your brother is coming and he's happy for you. He's not jealous because he's behaving like Menashe. He's not behaving like Cain. He's not behaving like Ishmael. He's not behaving like Esav. He's not behaving like Yosef's brothers. But here's the tikkun. I haven't given the hint to the tikkun yet. What happens when the story of Yosef starts until the verse after Yaakov learns that Yosef is alive? You know what's missing from the Torah? God. Who is there? The Medrash says, Ha'avos hein hein ha'merkava. Our patriarchs, and now every one of us, we have to carry that torch. The patriarchs were the chariot of God. They had to be the conduit to bring God's message down to the world. It was a world that was not ready to accept it, really. Right? You see, in Tanakh, Haggai and Zechariah make the point. It's really the main point of these two books is that until now, God wanted to deliver his message to you. Now he wants you to take that message to the world. They're ready to accept it. You bring it out to them. Don't let them Hellenize you. You Judaize them. And it worked a little. There were Misyahadim in Megillas Esther, but it didn't stick. It didn't stay. There are all kinds of reasons in Sefer Yirmiyahu for this, but it didn't stay. It didn't stay well enough. So, but here is your opportunity to be to be the Merkava of God, Yaakov. And you didn't do it. You were not the conduit that Avram and Yitzchak were for all those years that you thought Yosef was dead. So what did Chazal say that Yaakov did the minute he laid eyes? the minute he laid eyes on Yosef. Chazal say that only one of them cried. It says, Vayevk. By all other reunions, it's Vayevku. Right? Correct. He's saying Shema. So Be'er Yitzchak explains Rashi. He says, Yaakov realized at that moment, after his spirit returned, now that he recognized the melancholy nature of his existence for 22 years, maybe as comeuppance for the 22 years he spent away from Yitzchak and Rivka, but whatever it is, he says, for 22 years, which is the amount I see on the chat right now, for 22 years, there was a heder of Shem Hashem from the missing God, because Yaakov was not the conduit he was meant to be. And he makes up for it by saying Shema just at the moment. You have to say Shema just when you lay eyes on him. Yes, yes, I'm in charge now. And now God is coming back. And God comes right to Yaakov throughout this, the rest of Bereshis. So that is the head there. And that's where another connector to Megillas Esther and to Rus. Because Megillas Esther, you do get the sense that there is a vovness, if you will, a connecting theme. If Mordechai doesn't overhear the plot on the king's life, there's no story here. If Vashti chooses to come out that day, there's no story here. Right? There's so many different little small events. If that fly doesn't end up in Paro's cup, there's no story there, right? Everything needs every little piece of the story, Hashkacha Pratis, to realize that Kadosh Baruch Hu has it all laid out for us. But in Esther, you don't see God's name, right? Vanochi Aster Astir Panai Mikem, says the Gemara at the end of Cholon. It could also be that the nature of the story of Esther is the real nature of the story is hidden. That might go back to what Chagai and Zechariah were talking about, and I mentioned a few minutes ago. Ibn Ezra says that the name of God had to be hidden because who actually publicized this story? After all, we're still slaves of Achashverosh. That's why we don't have Hallel on Purim like on Hanukkah. But the runners, the Achashtronim ben Aram Ochim, they were the ones who spread the story out to all the kingdoms, right? If not, you know, if God is the hero of the story, then they're not going to do that. So Divrei Sholom ve'Emes, for Sholom Bayis, we kept God out of Megillas Esther. But the Emes, the Jews will know the Emes of who's really in charge of the story and who's the real melech in the story. But Megillas Rus, here is the Tikkun Chevra. In Megillas Rus, you can't go even a few psukim without seeing God's name. God does everything in this book. The people recognize it. The narrator recognizes it. If there's food in Israel, it's because God made the food come back to Israel. If I have been punished, Naomi, I think, gets it wrong in the story. She says, I left this place full. God brought me back empty. No, Naomi, God made you full. You came back empty by leaving. I don't know what else she was supposed to do. She should have, I don't know if she could convince her husband to return, but she surely should have convinced her sons to return earlier. Right? So all of the tikkunim that need to be made, say for shoftim of a fractious nature, of not wanting to go out and take responsibility. Boaz takes profound responsibility by convincing everybody that the women of Moab shouldn't be treated like the men of Moab. That's Kedusha Arim I said before. The concept was not totally accepted in Israel. We see the same Gemara in Yevamos I quoted before, is that when David killed Goliath, the king balked at giving him the reward for doing so, which is the hand of his daughter. He says, who is this guy who killed Goliath? His great-grandmother was Moabite. I'll be doing what Ploni Almoni was afraid of by giving him to my daughter. Right? Until Shmuel, who didn't know this at the time, he didn't know who David was at the time, he's told by God, what are you doing? You told me to crown David king, right? And now there's the Shaul is spreading the word through Avner and Doeg Adomi and everyone else that David has the halachic equivalence of a mamzer. So Hashem says, you know what you should do? Do some research. Go look up this, who is David's great-grandmother. Do the research and write about it. And Shmuel is smart. He writes about the opposition in the story. He didn't have to put in that there was a man named Ploni Almoni who refused. What do you have to put that in? When you put in the refusal, then you can say, come on, we dealt with this already 3 generations ago. You hear it? He didn't have to put in Ploni Almoni's refusal in the story. That was a very smart strategy. He puts it in to let everybody know there was refusal back then, but someone named Boaz carried the day, and he brought 10 men to publicize it. Okay? Chevra, That's about it for all the tikkunim. God's name has a tikkun. The responsibility has a tikkun. The Jews gathering together have a tikkun. And the kingdom of Israel has a tikkun. As the Shvot HaShoftim turns into the Malchus Yisrael, and Chesed can take a woman and elevate her from the hated status of a Moabite nation that had been subjugating us for 18 years and had been one of the only two nations that can't convert. Amalek can convert, but Ammon and Moab can't. But she changed and then moved to a different direction and got Boaz to support her. And she takes all those vavs and connects us to all these things, to responsibility, to brotherhood, and to Shem Hashem, which it returns to this book in a significant way. Okay, Chevra, that's the book of Ruth. I hope that that maybe you can unmute people now, Rick Hellman, so I can answer if there are questions.
Thank you very much. You can look at the chat box while I thank you. And you turned Sefer Ruth into a book for Elul, a Truva Sefer, which is nice. And I love the comparison to Yosef and Yehuda and Tamar. That aspect, which I had really never heard of or thought before. I thought that was very, very fascinating at the beginning. But thank you very much. You can take a look at the questions. I can unmute people, although it's I prefer not doing that quite yet.
Boaz does a direct tikkun of his ancestor Yehuda by marrying Ruth and giving her a child. Yes, that's what Rabbi Kelman just mentioned. That's great. That's I think that's the part of the thematic connection with Parshas Vayeshev. They're made linguistically with Penashchisis Nachlasi and Vatishoches Zaraotzer. There are numerous other examples. And the Vav, this is really something significant. And what does the field in question, why does the field belong to Naomi? I think I mentioned that earlier, is because when her husband had to sell it, when they left, the obligation goes to a close relative. The closer the relative, the more the obligation in order to do that. Okay, yes, saying Shema was the correct answer to what Yaakov was doing at that point. And thank you for all these thank yous. he echoes the Joseph story. Is that why God's name is absent in it? So Megillat Esther definitely echoes the Yosef story. I had a different wrinkle on it because I chose Rus, but absolutely. In fact, there's much more written on Megillat Esther's connection to Yosef than Megillat Ruth's connection to Yosef. That's for sure. Both Megillat Esther and the Yosef story involve a Jewish people who are torn from their original place and taken to an exiled place, and they reach, in the case of Mordechai, and Yosef, by supplying a king with valuable information. In the case of Mordechai, the assassination attempt. In the case of Yosef, Paro's dream. They're elevated at some point of the story to for some purpose that's not may not be known at the time certain time of the story. But by the end of the story, it's all clearly well known. And it's yes, it's about the success that the Jew is able actually to succeed in the unfriendly environment. In the Haskalah, they said you should be a Yehudi be'ohalecha ve'ish b'tzeisecha. Right? You ever hear of that statement? So Mordechai says, it says, ish Yehudi haya b'shushan habira. Why do we have to say that? Why do we have to sacrifice our Yehudiness when we go out? We can be just the same Yehudi b'shushan habira as we are in our ohel. So that's yes, definitely the case that we see that Yosef, when in the beginning of Shmos, when it says Yosef Hayah b'Mitzrayim, and Rashi says that Yosef maintained his tzidkus even though he was in the flesh pots of Egypt. How does Rashi know that from the three words Yosef Hayah b'Mitzrayim? So good Mefarshim to Rashi explain, because it says it could have said Yosef b'Mitzrayim, or as the Targum says, Im Yosef b'Mitzrayim. Yosef Hayah b'Mitzrayim is telling us Yosef Hayah, he remained as he always was. You have drushes in Chazal like this all the time. Havaya, right? The Haysali Ishacher, the Hayah im Shamoa, the Hayuhad Rimo Eile. You have a lot of Hayah meanings like as it is, right? So Yosef Hayah b'Mitzrayim, he had a Havaya, he had the same Havaya he always had, and he maintained his moral equilibrium even though he was in the diaspora, which is what we say about Mordechai. Okay. Where do the women of the chorus in the division, where do the women of the chorus about Naomi fit? There are women there. Yes, so you can say there are certainly characters. I would say that the women fit together with the boy who introduces Naomi. They fit. I don't think they're negative chesed, only because in this scheme, negative chesed in the book that's dedicated to chesed, I'm sorry to say, die. They just do what's expected of them, and if you do what's expected of you, you fall away. Ploni Almoni has a name according to Chazal. His name is Tov. And you go lech Tov, you go. Ploni Almoni is just, you know, John Doe, because the terminology does appear only one other time regarding a place in Sefer Melachim. But it just means, I don't want to name you, so I'm just going to say, call you Ploni Almoni. You didn't want to perpetuate Mahlon's name, so we're not going to perpetuate your name. Big deal. Right? So I think the women, in their reaction, oh, look at that. Look at Naomi. Huh? Look at her. Now we're riding high, and she's a homeless woman who has to eat gathered grain. Oh, how nice, you know? It's like schadenfreude. You know, that's leave it to the Germans to come up with a word that means being happy with someone else's tragedy. So I think it's just maybe just natural for them to just feel, oh, look what happened to her when she leaves us, you know, right? How does Sarah's being in the tent translate to the Moabite women? Because the angels were told by God to go down and see if it's the way of women to greet strangers. If it's the way of women to greet strangers with bread and water, then the women of Moab deserve to be punished the same as the men of Moab for not doing that when we left Egypt. The whole point of Boaz, and then the point of those who argued in favor of David to marry the king's daughter, was that Moabite women should be treated differently than Moabite men regarding the Torah law, Lo Yovo Amoni Moabi Bekal Hashem, that Mammonites and Moabites may not join our kehila. They can convert, but they would be the halachic equivalents of a mamzer who's not allowed to marry a Jew. Then that's why Shaul balked at letting David marry his daughter as the reward for killing Goliath. But if it's not the way of women to greet strangers with bread and water, then the women of Moab are in the clear. You get it? So Ayei Sara Ishtecha Hinei Ba'ohel is, according to the Chiddush Arim, with the tongue in cheek maybe, the most important dialogue in the whole Torah. It justifies the kingdom of David, right? Otherwise, the kingdom of David is Mamzeris. Because this way we don't treat the women the same as the men. But those who detracted from David, who didn't think he should become king, and Ploni Almoni, were worried that maybe the halacha is not that way, and maybe the women of Moab deserve to be treated just the same as the men of Moab. So when the angels saw that Sarah didn't run out to greet them like Avraham, so then it makes sense to take our time to let the Lot survive with his two daughters, so that one of them could have a descendant named Ruth, and one of them could have a descendant named Naama, and to be part of the Davidic dynasty, right? Of all of Shlomo's 1,000 wives, the woman who was the mother of the next king, Rechavam, was an Ammonite. She was born an Ammonite. Her name was Naama HaAmonis. Okay? You have an interesting explanation for, she was better to you than seven sons. I believe that is placed in the text because Shmuel is our greatest prophet after Moshe, and he knows that his mother sang a song when he was born that says that God takes barren women and makes them give birth to seven. Right, the Gemara in Brachas considers Shmuel to be Guvra Begavrin, like two men, and then she had five other children afterwards. So Shmuel is two, plus five is seven. I think I don't doubt that she said it, but seven is just a large number. She wasn't hoping to have other children. In fact, Chazal say that Boaz died shortly afterwards. So it just means it's just a large number. You know, you get married, you expect to have a child or more. Right, and more means seven, so I think that's how it is. And remember, keep in mind that Shmuel is the author, and look at Shmuel Be Aleph chapter 2, and you'll see perhaps some kind of connection there. Is the Abigail is the woman who brought food to David when her husband didn't? Yes, because by that time she was scared that not doing so would cause the death of everybody in her camp on Megillah Daf Yudalid, says that that's how we know that she was a prophetess, because she knew that if David does this, he will never become king. And then she became his wife shortly afterwards. But yes, there certainly are other places where we see that women, and certainly today, that things might have changed. And by that's only at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim. We don't necessarily say that today, that the passivity of women at the time, and of Sarah regarding Avraham, she probably gets more credit for whatever was served to those angels. He's just the one that's on the outside. That situation might certainly change with time, and circumstance. Absolutely, Moabite women seduced Israelite men into Avodah Zarah. They aren't innocent. Yes, that's Moabite women in the time of the Torah, and perhaps even afterwards. All the more reason why Ruth and women like Ruth or Paro's daughter deserve our great admiration and to be the. To have such an exalted status in our liturgy as well as our canon, because of being such paradigms of chesed given their backgrounds. Shlomo's son Rechavim precipitated the vision of the kingdom. Is it fair to equate his mother with Ruth? I hear the question. It's a Gemara in Vamos that says when David said Pitachto lemoserai, you have opened up my ropes that bound me, that bind me. So the Gemara can calls those two ropes Rus ha'amoavis v'nama ha'amonis. Naama's generally treated well in Chazal. It comes down to us as a Jewish name, no doubt. Again, I say I just had a granddaughter in Israel named Naama, and. I would say that why David is concerned with Shlomo's Ammonite wife, it's hard to imagine. But think it like this: when Rechavim became king, he was 41. Shlomo ruled 40 years. That means that Rechavim was already born before Shlomo became king, when David was still alive. In other words, the Paro's daughter is not the first non-Israelite king that Shlomo married. David married off Shlomo while David was still king to an Ammonite woman. So Rechavim is probably his oldest son, right? So those are the two ropes that he says, not only Rus Amoavis, but also Naamah Amonis. So that might explain that. Ruth's tikkun was converting to Judaism and providing sustenance to Naomi. Direct, like for like tikkun. Yes, yeah. I think that it's, in fact, that's that nature of chesed, is that it's a boomerang, right? And that's, I think that's exactly what Naomi's doing from the Masorah of chapter 3, which says that Naomi really wanted Boaz for herself. Look at the Masorah of all those verbs that look to be in first person, which are turned to second person. I will agree that some ancient Near Eastern languages have first person with the like second person Hebrew, so it could be some old remnant of such a shita. But I'll take the midrash that says that it's a sign that really Naomi wants to put on a beautiful dress and put on makeup and perfume and possibly seduce Boaz, but she says you chose your mother-in-law over your mother. So now I'm gonna let you get the man I want in return a favor, like almost like Mida Kanegan Mida, like that beautiful last message asks. And the very last message I see here is